Nothing.
So while the photos have been taken, just by way of introduction, Andrew Nichols is going to talk about the MAA's journey to a risk-based regulator. I think Andrew needs no introduction, since he was introduced in earlier today. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Andrew.
Great. Thank you, Peter. I guess what I want to talk about is the transformation over the last 3 years of the regulation of the compulsory third-party insurance scheme in New South Wales and to a risk-based approach. And risk-based approaches to regulation have become increasingly the norm for governments around the world as they attempt to deal with making private sector and not-for-profit sectors more accountable for the delivery of public outcomes that they in turn are being held to account for. So I wanted to start by just talking about the difference between a risk-based approach to regulation and the more traditional approach to regulation. So traditionally, we regard regulation as the exertion of public authority through a system of rules and laws in which the regulator ensures technical compliance by the regulated. That is, the regulator focuses mostly on what is legal or illegal. So if you look at the diagram up there, the traditional focus of a regulator is that circle called illegal. The risk-based approach to regulation has emerged in recent years, and it's become the standard policy of most governments around the world to move to a more risk-based approach. And what's different about a risk-based approach is that it's much more focused on outcomes and focused in particular on the harms to achieving those outcomes. The approach has been described by Malcolm Sparrow, who is a famous Harvard academic in the area of risk-based regulation. And so the circles that you see there is from his pieces of work. And what he identifies is that when a regulator looks out at its operating environment, it will see a mix of things. It will see a mix of things that are illegal, and it will see a mix of things that are harmful. And the challenge for a regulator is that if they focus on those things that are illegal and not harmful, so they're the things on the sort of the left-hand side, the regulator gets accused of being unreasonable or obsolete or nitpicky, focusing on the things that are just about ticker-box compliance. At the other extreme, though, when regulators focus on things that are harmful but are outside the area of laws, it gets the regulator into the territory of things that they're not authorised to do, things that will have them accused of being involved in mission creep or being entrepreneurial, which I'm not sure whether being entrepreneurial is a good or a bad thing for a regulator to be. And so I guess for a regulator, the sweet spot's that area in the middle where you've got the things that are both harmful and illegal, and so they're the obvious areas for priority setting for regulators. And the challenge for regulators in moving to this risk-based approach is very much getting a balance between these two extremes and setting priorities. So what the regulator is therefore able to do by taking a risk-based approach is to move away from technical compliance for its own sake, but to focus those areas of priority which are largely in that sort of middle area. And this approach allows a regulator to apply a much greater or a better use of their limited resources towards the things that are the most harmful. Now, a central aspect of a risk-based approach to regulation is the notion of selecting a range of instruments that a regulator can use. And those who went to Jeff Atkins' presentation just prior to this, you'd have seen some examples of some of the tools that a regulator can use. And the approach of a risk-based approach is to move beyond the traditional hard-type regulation, investigations, auditing, licensing, etc., and move the role of the regulator much more into what Malcolm Sparrow calls soft regulation, which is education programs, advisory services, standards, funding, research, and so on. this is what Malcolm Sparrow calls the craft of regulation. It's actually the art of determining the right regulatory response to a particular situation. So in this sense, from an outcomes-based point of view, regulatory burden is not an end in itself. And hence the adoption of risk-based approaches to regulation often go hand in hand with perceptions of a pullback from unnecessary regulation or red tape. And so as a result, risk-based regulation is often regarded as the same as light-touch regulation. But actually that's not always the case. Certainly it is where you're pulling back from that nitpicky ticker-box type regulation, but where it's what it's really trying to do is to focus the efforts and the resources of the regulator to the things of highest priority. So, in fact, rather than see it as light-touch regulation, you're better off to see it as right-touch regulation. And it's very much a top-down approach. So when a regulator is looking at the outcomes that it is trying to achieve on behalf of the community, it's then about choosing the right tool from amongst these tools to use that is relevant and proportionate to the risk that the regulator is dealing with or the harm that the regulator is dealing with. So in some cases, the right response to a particular risk is going to be hard-edged audits and licensing, because that might be the nature of the problem. So it's not the case that risk-based regulation is actually about light-touch regulation. At the heart of the risk-based regulatory model is the idea of agility. This is a big difference from the traditional model. A traditional model sees a set of rules and laws that gets created, and the regulator then spends its time focusing on compliance to those rules and laws. Whereas a risk-based approach is agile and top-down. And I've tried to sort of draw it here as a cycle. You could see it as a hierarchy, but I think a cycle works a little bit better because it actually shows that there's this feedback loop of agility around the idea of articulating the objectives. So the regulator plays a key role in articulating the objectives for all of the participants in that system that they're regulating, as well as the broader community. They then have a role of monitoring and scanning and using data analytics to see what's actually going on. And from that, they identify risks. And risk identification is at the heart of the role of a risk-based regulator. Then you choose the appropriate tool, you evaluate performance, and you constantly review. And so you're continually going back to articulate the objectives. The idea of this risk-based approach means that there's this constant focus on outcomes and a willingness to move around the options and tools that are being used in order to meet those outcomes and to avoid the risk that the regulator itself starts to become stale and unable to respond to new challenges that are emerging in markets. What it also means is that it's much clearer for the people who are being regulated that it's better to get on board with the outcome rather than focusing on a cat and mouse game with the regulator, because the regulator expresses its willingness to change the rules as it goes along. Now, risk-based regulation is becoming very common in a lot of aspects of public administration theory, so I'm not going to dwell on it to a large degree, but I think it's just relevant to think about how it works in this context, which is that governments, which is what the authorising environment is in a model that was developed by Mark Moore, another Harvard academic, the government as the authorising environment is accountable back to the community who are assessing the value of the services being delivered by the public sector as well as private and not-for-profit sectors. In turn, that authorising environment gives its public sector agencies, including its regulators, the authority and the resources that they need in order to deliver public value. And in the case of a regulator, the regulator's primary job is to act as the link point, if you like, between the authorising environment and public value. They play a role in exercising authority over those that are regulated. They have a role to monitor performance to see how well things are going, and then to build an operational capability that is agile and able to respond to risks as they emerge. Now, the reason why this is becoming really popular in government sectors, you just see at the moment how government, traditional approaches to government regulation are struggling. So you see the challenges that governments are dealing with Uber at the moment, or other sort of shared economy advances, where the traditional model isn't agile. So it can't recognise that there are new ways of delivering a particular service. And as a result, those systems are caught out. And so you can see the attraction for governments in moving to a more risk-based approach. I guess at the heart of it is that governments are still held to account for the performance in the insurance market, now turning to the insurance market, even if it's private insurers. And so hence, whether it's at the federal level with the various federal regulatory bodies or at the state level with the various statutory schemes, the pressure has been on governments to make sure that those sectors are working effectively. And so we've seen a number of changes to the regulatory framework at the federal level, for example, with insurance over the last 10 years, 15 years or so since the HIH fallout. Now, I guess I want to sort of put a general stake in the ground, which is that I actually think there are some advantages, some innate advantages to a risk-based approach when it comes to private insurance. Firstly, you've got an industry that has scale and a relatively tight structure, which gives the regulator a head start. And compared to, say, you know, the regulator of restaurants and cafes or something like that, those companies are usually professional organisations that are concerned about reputation, they're concerned about the financial bottom line to their companies, and it's possible to engage with them more or less directly, particularly in a market like CTP in New South Wales, where you've got five insurance companies. And provided that the regulator avoids regulatory capture, which is something that, again, Jeff Atkins touched on in his presentation this morning, for the most part, the companies that are involved in these markets are concerned about their customers and their reputation. And so these things give a head start for a regulator operating in this space. But there are also some natural barriers to delivering successful outcomes, particularly getting that juggling act between the commercial interests of the insurer and the public interest that the regulator is pursuing. And I guess my sort of hypothesis is that in personal injury schemes, that's particularly the case, more so than other lines of insurance. And I guess I've got sort of three reasons for saying that. The first reason is that the culture and nature of personal injury is by nature adversarial. These systems are usually designed around laws, regulations, guidelines, procedures, and disputes emerge in these systems over time about the application of rules. Statutory schemes are, by definition, rule-based schemes because that's implicit in the title. And that means that the sort of improvements that insurers might have made in other lines are sometimes held back because you've got rules about how you actually behave or operate in the personal injury sector. And there are less or fewer incentives on the insurer to improve performance, given that these schemes, particularly CTP in New South Wales, is a third-party system and it involves a long and adversarial process. Now, the challenge for the regulator on this in this area is to make sure that it doesn't become part of the game. And my view is that over time, the New South Wales CTP market has developed an orientation towards really heavy rule-based focus on weather and technical compliance, which has been a factor that the former MAA contributed to. And so part of what I'll come to for us as the MAA is breaking that cycle and allowing the regulator to play a stronger role in actually setting expectations. The second area of challenge is the one that I've already touched on, which is that you have an inherent conflict between the regulator's objectives to deliver public value and the insurer's commercial objectives, which in the case of CTP is both the objective to avoid certain risks and also to defend against claims, particularly where it's a third-party system. Now, this can be a positive tension, and arguably this scheme, the CTP scheme in New South Wales, has had a benefit over a period of time of playing to those incentives of insurers in order to drive sensible underwriting strategies and also to not pay out willfully and excessively for claims that are without merit. But on the other hand, there is also the risk that has emerged where the players in the system start to see it as a game, and so they start to push the boundaries of what's allowable or use the rules to justify poor treatment of an otherwise legitimate claim, trying to test the regulator's own mettle, or it's entirely possible that the insurer just performs poorly in areas that the private sector is meant to perform well in. And so when that happens, the tension goes back onto the regulator from the point of view of governments and the community about what are they doing about that. But on the optimistic side, the benefit of private delivery is the ability for the regulator to develop systems that actually harness insurers' natural commercial drives towards that public outcome, and that's the balance that I guess we've been trying to achieve. The third challenge for the regulator in this space is that they're not only regulating the insurers, they're actually involved in a complex ecosystem that starts before the accidents even occurred in the case of CTP. So it's back in the road safety space. And if you look at that diagram that runs across the bottom of the slide up there, you'll see that there's sort of an end-to-end view of the experience of the entire system, from the road safety, the insurance cover stages, which are all before the incident occurs. There's an immediate response. There's hospitalisation, there's subsequent treatment and care, there's a claims process, there's a dispute process, and for some people there's a support process, which I didn't draw up there, particularly for people who have no prospect of returning to work. So the key point is that these systems can fail anywhere on this chain. So, you know, we can see frequency of claims go up. Propensity to claim can go up. Insurers could spend too much in their expenses. Legal representation may increase. Average claim size might go up. There could be over-servicing. There could be too many disputes, or there could be too many accidents happening in the first place, or there could be poor practices in the hospital. All of these things, and there are many others, can put pressure on the cost of running a scheme. And these are things that go beyond the immediate questions of the underwriting and pricing of the scheme. This is actually about a line of sight over a whole system. And in my mind, this sets regulators in personal injury apart from some other regulators that are out there that regulate a very specific aspect of the operation of a business or an industry. In this case, we need to have this kind of line of sight over the system as a whole. And it's not always easy because you don't always have the powers to directly influence those things. And that's why a risk-based approach is really important, because it allows us to look at each point in that value chain and to make an assessment as to where the highest risk currently is, what's the thing that's driving cost, and then to drive resources and effort towards those things. So that's the top-down view of a risk-based approach to regulation. It's an attempt to try and stop focusing on the symptom and actually to go back and understand more clearly what the cause of a particular harm is. So just turning a little bit more to our experience over the last few years, the green slip scheme in New South Wales has been under pressure really since 2008, when the global financial crisis first hit, pushing yield rates down, but also, perhaps more insidiously, claims frequency started to rise from about that time onwards, and in the last couple of years it's been rising quite dramatically. And the combined effect of a range of these pressures has then put upward pressure on prices, which is the sort of thing that, you know, gets politicians excited. At the same time, there's been a lot of chatter in the public domain, in the political world, around things like insurer profit and affordability. And so that's brought into sort of stark relief, I guess, the regulatory model that we've been operating under historically at the MAA. Now, the government tried to reform the scheme in 2013 unsuccessfully, but at about that time we were looking at our regulatory model and really testing our, you know, the presumptions of the model that we were previously operating under at the MAA. And so although those scheme reforms did not succeed, we certainly set a course of making demonstrable improvements to the way we regulate the scheme. and very much moving to a risk-based approach. So very early on in that journey, we spent a lot of time actually assessing and reasserting the objectives that we were trying to achieve, using the data that we had at the time to identify what we saw as the key points of failure, the key points of highest harm or highest risk, in order to put our focus on those areas. And we embedded that into our business plans. And we came up with about 50 projects that we implemented over the course of about a 2.5-year period. We didn't do all 50 at once, but it was kind of a prioritised approach to implementing those changes. And it meant that we reviewed, for example, all of our regulatory instruments, top to bottom, and a real shift to a focus on principles and trying to get the appropriate balance between prescription, where the risk warranted it, and description, where it was appropriate to allow insurers to play to their strengths of underwriting or claims management, rather than having the regulator trying to tell the insurer how to do their business. So this has very much been about the regulator playing to its strengths of being able to determine and measure and make adjustments to regulatory instruments in relation to objective setting and identifying priorities, while allowing the insurers to play to their strengths, but in a model that overcomes some of those inherent tensions that I talked about earlier, where insurers have incentives to avoid certain risks or to behave in a particular way with claims. One of the key parts when we did our risk identification early on was the identification of our lack of business intelligence, and that, again, historically the MAA had relatively limited data about what was actually going on out in the scheme that we were regulating. So we've set about improving our claims information. We've introduced some new databases for policy data. We've just gone live with a new database for legal costs, which is one of the few schemes in Australia, I think, that actually now gets full legal cost disclosure from law firms for the total expenses that they make on claims. For those of you who are at the morning session, I referred to some work we've been doing building much greater data linkage. And we've been working with insurers proactively around identifying things like this increase in claims frequency. And our ability to respond to that and to work collaboratively with the insurance sector is something that I think would have been a lot harder for us to do a few years ago. But we're now much better positioned to have line of sight about what's actually going on, to know what sort of questions we need to ask, and then ask them and work with insurers around that. That's still a journey for us. We still need to do more in that space, but certainly business intelligence, without it, you know, we can't do our job as a risk-based regulator. We can't see what's actually going on in order to be able to steer the ship towards public outcomes. There have been a range of customer improvement projects. I won't go through those in detail given the time frame, but these have been some things that we've done to support better outcomes for people who are injured, helping them on their journey as a claimant, and navigating the system. Again, there's more for us to do in that space, but we've also been doing a number of improvements for vehicle owners with improvements to the green slip calculator and improving some of the processes for purchasing a green slip, which for those who are not from New South Wales is a separate transaction from the registration. And so we've got some more things we want to do in those areas. But collectively it's about building up more information and providing a role for the regulator to have more reach with the people that we serve, who are ultimately the people who are injured and the people who are insured. This, in turn, is allowing us to have a stronger role to assert leadership and management of the scheme and to be much more shrewd in the way we deal with the various service providers that are operating in this in the scheme. Now, this is not to say that everything's gone swimmingly and or to say that this has been easy or straightforward. In fact, a risk-based approach to regulation is hard. It's harder work than the traditional approach because the traditional approach is a bit more sort of set and forget. With a risk-based approach, you've really got to apply a much greater level of agility. But it also requires a different approach and demeanour by the regulator. And that's been part of the challenge, I guess, in terms of building a risk-based approach and then making it stick. So I guess I've asked it as a question at this stage because we're starting on this journey. You know, will the new risk-based approach stick? Well, the approach we're taking is consistent with government policy. It's had strong support at ministerial level and at board level. And as I mentioned a minute ago, it really is about trying to play to respective strengths. But importantly, it's not just a change in instruments. At its heart, it's also about changes of behaviour and culture. And that's hard, and that's much more a proposition over a longer time period. It's shifting to a model where the regulator is holding the insurers more clearly account to the delivery of outcomes and not just the letter of the law. Now, this is a new approach, and I guess that new approach has led to some scepticism, both from our own internal staff, who are used to doing things a particular way, and from the insurers ourselves, who are kind of wondering, is this a new phase of a game or is this actually something new? And unless we work hard at it as a regulator, then we run the risk of retreating back to the sort of more traditional approach to regulation. For our staff, they're probably thinking maybe one day Andrew will disappear and, you know, we can go back to, you know, life how it used to be. And it's been very much about embedding for staff a new way of operating, building models inside the business that have them much more accountable for outcomes. I've established an outcomes-based business plan with staff now accountable for delivering those outcomes, not in their traditional silos. It's been about getting building an agile framework of risk identification and amendment inside the business and then working really hard at it at my level and at the next levels down within the organisation so that people know this is serious, important and have it stick. Likewise, it's been about engagement with the insurance companies at the most senior level, presenting at the Insurance Council Board, me meeting individually with CEOs, and then working collaboratively with the leaders within the insurance companies to get more proactive engagement. It's been about more proactive engagement with stakeholders, getting them involved in the reviews of these instruments and demonstrably showing what you know what we're doing with them and what we have done with them and being a much more open process. So I mentioned this legal cost disclosure thing. I think that was a really great achievement. It could have been a really adversarial arrangement with the lawyers, but it wasn't. The lawyers came back and said it was fantastic to deal with us through that process. They knew where they stood and they became our advocates standing side by side with us in selling this out to the legal profession. So it's been very much about building that collaboration. But I guess I've just thrown up some questions there, which I guess are still some areas where there's a lack of clarity and things we've got to work at over time. Now, how does all of this work in an adversarial rule-based system? How do we bring risk-based approaches to an adversarial system? Is this an example of the regulator overreaching? How can it do some of these things if, in fact, the law has certain statements? And I guess what we've been trying to do here with a principles-based approach is to embed the principles and objectives inside the regulatory instruments, which, fortunately, we have some latitude over. Is it a new approach to partnership or a continuation of a game? Is it actually pro-claimant? Are we turning into an advocate for claimants or, in fact, are we trying to drive a more customer-focused approach to their experience? And how, you know, does the regulator want both? And that was a question that was asked at this morning session about how do we juggle this with the pressure to also hold back against against a wave of claims frequency coming into the system. How will the insurers know they're compliant? Because under the new approach, insurers are held to account for outcomes against a business plan rather than a set of laws. And how will we approach different approaches with insurers? So these are things that we're still working through with insurers as we develop a more risk-based approach. So I guess in conclusion, there's more to do. We're on a journey that requires ongoing tending. As I mentioned earlier, it is harder work than a rule-based approach, but I think it offers a prospect of better outcomes. But I think the jury's still out on how successful or otherwise it might be as we deal with an adversarial rule-based designed system. So on that note, I'll say thank you and open it to questions.
So there's a microphone in the middle. If anyone has any questions, I will make one observation. I think that legal cost data you're collecting will be a subject of some very interesting analysis, and I think many schemes will be interested in the results, and maybe a paper will be produced in 2 years' time at this seminar.
There you go.
Bruce?
Thanks, Andrew. Bruce Watson from Comcare. It's great to see Malcolm Sparrow's work being promoted. He's been an influence in our regulatory work, our safety regulatory, for quite a while, and he did a workshop for us as an executive a couple of years ago. It was terrific, very engaging speaker with a good turn of phrase. He characterised the traditional model as think once, act for the same for 15 years, and the more risk-based agile model as spot and squish, which is a nice turn of phrase for those who haven't heard him speak before. My question... One of the challenges of adopting the risk-based, more agile approach is accountability and measurement. So the traditional measurement questions and the ones we get at Centred Estimates and so on is always how many inspectors have you got, how many improvement notices have they lodged, etc., etc. If you move to a more risk-based approach, you've got to be very clear about your objectives and your measurement. So have you given some thought as to how you'll be able to demonstrate that you're actually achieving better regulatory outcomes under that model?
Yes, we have, and I think it's a very good point. typically, regulators sort of gravitate towards measuring outputs because they're demonstrable things you can measure, you know, how many audits have we conducted and that sort of thing. So absolutely, that's the sort of the historical approach. One of the things that we've been doing is building the sort of performance measures that we're going to collect at the same time we're rolling out these new performance requirements. And some of those things are qualitative and some of those things are quantitative. So one of the requirements, to give you an example, of the new system requires insurers to produce a business plan for us about how they're going to go about their market practices and their acquisition strategies. And the way we've approached it is to really establish a set of principles and to put the onus on the insurers to come up with a business plan that we're satisfied with, but that when we look at it, we go, yes, that's going to meet the outcome. And then embedded within that plan is some harder performance measures that we get back, but it's also supported by a process of dialogue and engagement, of actually building up the business intelligence of a regulator doesn't only come from the hard numbers. It actually comes from regular communication and talking with the people that we regulate, and from that building a picture. It's a storytelling exercise around what's actually going on inside the scheme. What that is still a work in progress is working us towards more public reporting against how we're travelling against those sorts of things. So it's still a work in progress. But absolutely we're embedding in these new regulatory instruments a focus on how we're going to measure the performance and then using qualitative and quantitative measures to pull that together.
Any other questions? Len?
The newness of it, because of the newness of the approach in terms of the environment and the complexity and the uncertainty that must be in the mind of insurers. Ironically, do you actually begin to introduce regulator risk to the cost factor of the scheme for insurers? And the risk there, I think, of regulatory superimposed inflation?
Well, I think that's always a risk. I don't know that that's a risk particular to a risk-based approach. because you can equally have traditional regulators that impose vast requirements on an insurer also. So the prospect that the risk-based approach offers, but you know regulators don't always get it right, is to enable the right touch of regulation as required, and that may mean extra requirements on an insurer if the regulator, from a top-down perspective, thinks that that's what's necessary in terms of delivering the public outcome. So if the regulator believes the risk is so high in terms of likelihood or consequence and that the prospect of the market sorting it out for itself is low, then the regulator probably has to step in with tougher requirements. In that case, the regulator is consciously making a decision to create extra requirements and consciously identifying that that may create extra work on behalf of the person you're regulating, which is different to the traditional approach, which is, you know, give us everything and we'll kind of work it out later on as to whether you're compliant. So there's always a risk of regulatory sort of failure, if you like, I think, in any regulatory model, but at least the risk-based approach puts a bit more onus on the regulator and I think allows also a dialogue back with the regulator about... from the people who are being regulated, in this case the insurers, to be able to say, well, do we really need to do that? And, you know, that's been part of our journey where we would get feedback from insurers in this process going, really? You know, that's going to be a really big task for us. You know, do you really need that? And then we've gone, well, maybe not that much. Or, actually, no, we really think we need that level of information. And I know it's painful, but at this point we think the risk warrants it. So it is a risk in any regulatory model, but I think the risk-based approach has the prospect of dealing with that more efficiently.
Thank you. Andrew, I might just ask a question. The CDP scheme in New South Wales has for many years, 15-odd years, had parliamentary oversight. My question is, how does that drive or influence what the regulator does, particularly in a risk-based approach?
Ooh, okay. That's probably a paper in its own right. Very good question. I guess, firstly, we need to distinguish between, I guess, grandstanding that happens in parliamentary processes and not be captive to responding to things simply because there's a particular member of a committee or whatever that's likely to take a particular approach on things. And so we've sort of parked that. But parliamentary oversight is a way... where it's working properly and effectively is a way for a regulator to actually get feedback from that authorising environment that I sort of showed on that sort of triangle document earlier on. It's a key way for us to know whether there's a perception of us performing well in terms of the sort of public interest that's being asked of us. I think it's healthy to have that kind of oversight because it does... mean that as a regulator, I have to be conscious of how does this play out in the public domain? How does this play out? You know, it's like the Senate estimates example of the earlier question. How will this play out? And can I be seen as acting reasonably, appropriately towards the objectives of the scheme? But I think that there is, on the flip side, a level of political grandstanding that does tend to sometimes... undermine what should otherwise be a very open process of inquiry.
Any more questions? I've got another one for you. In New South Wales, CDP, it's a basic common law scheme for third party. How would the risk-based approach change both the roles of the regulator and the functions it undertakes if the scheme went to a no-fault defined benefit scheme?
Okay. Well, risk-based regulation in its concept should apply across the board. I mean, it's one of the reasons why risk-based regulation generally is being adopted in all sorts of areas of government regulation. Now, the way it might execute... its activities, the kind of things that would be the priorities, the areas of focus and the particular regulatory tools would probably be different, I suspect, in a different kind of model because the risks would look different. And I dare say even if we were in a common law system this time in 10 years, we'll probably have a different profile of risk and harms as well, and so some of the tools will be different as well. That's that agility piece, that a regulatory model can stand the test of change. In fact, if even more importantly, the risk-based regulatory model is also about building the business intelligence to support those sort of changes. So whatever that looks like. So I'm not saying here that that's a defined benefit scheme. It could be, you know, whatever. And I think that the previous approach to regulation wouldn't have allowed us to as effectively identified new harms and risks, and therefore in some cases where you don't have anything in the regulatory toolkit, the right regulatory response is to go back to your authorising environment and say, I need more powers. So fraud's a good example. We have limited powers. That was something that was raised this morning. So maybe we need more powers. Or go back to the authorising environment and say, you know what, you need to change the design, because we've reached the point where we're not sure as a regulator we can kind of push this any further. That's a legitimate part of the risk-based approach, whereas the traditional approach to regulation would not see the possibilities beyond the immediate thing that you're regulating. And I think that's the core difference.
Any more questions? I think we're about out of time anyway. So if you'd like to thank Andrew.